Lecture 11, The Beginning and the End, The Chronicles of Narnia, Part 3.
In this lecture, we shall consider the final two chronicles, The Magician's Nephew and The Last Battle, stories that relate the creation and destruction of Narnia. In our analysis, we shall focus on how the good and evil characters react differently, not only to Aslan's miracles and commands, but to his very nature and reality. Now, The Magician's Nephew is my second favorite chronicle after The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and it tells the thrilling story of the creation of Narnia. That is to say, though it comes sixth in the Chronicles, it actually precedes, chronologically speaking, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And because of this, most modern booksellers publish the Chronicles of Narnia not as they were originally published, but in chronological order, with The Magician's Nephew first, then The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, then The Horse and His Boy, and then the other four. Now, I prefer definitely the traditional ordering, and that's the version I've given you, but I have to admit, and I hate to admit it, that before he died, Lewis did sanction the new ordering. I think he was going senile, but anyway, I must tell you that he sanctioned it. But I prefer it this way much better, because then when you read The Magician's Nephew, you have the surprise of finding the origin of what you already read in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, as you will see as we go along. The Magician's Nephew begins in the early 1900s, Earth years, when two children, Diggory and Polly, stumble upon the hidden room of Diggory's Uncle Andrew. Now, that doesn't sound very interesting, but Uncle Andrew is a magician, and he has in his possession a set of yellow and green rings that have the power to transport you to another world and then bring you back. Now, Uncle Andrew lusts after this knowledge of another world, but he's too much of a coward to risk the journey himself. And so he actually manipulates and tricks Polly and Diggory into grabbing the rings and sends them. Well, the rings work, but not as Andrew thought. They don't take the children to another world, but instead take them to a sort of way station. A magical wood dotted with ponds. And each one of those ponds is a doorway to another world. Lewis calls this place the wood between the worlds. Well, the children soon realize that each pond goes to a different world, so they say, hey, let's explore. They jump into a pond, and they end up in the world of Charn. Now, Charn is not a place you want to go because it's a dead world. You can still breathe there, but there's no living things. No animals, not even any insects. The sun looks like it's about to explode. Well, the children wander around through the deserted, dying streets until they come to a huge hall. And in the hall, they find a whole series of statues, and they look like kings and queens. And the beginning statues look very gentle and kind, but as you move down, they look more and more cruel, more and more selfish. At the end of the row of statues is a giant statue of a woman, a queen, who is very, very beautiful, but very, very cruel looking. And next to her is a little stand with a bell and a hammer, and there's a little inscription that tempts you, go ahead and ring the bell and see what happens. Well, Polly says don't do it, but Diggory impulsively picks up the hammer and hits the bell. You hear a dong go, and guess what happens? The statue of that woman comes to life. And to their horror, the children learn that that woman, her name is Queen Jadis, was actually responsible for the destruction of Charn. And then she tells them, now, children, I'm going to go to your world and take it over. Well, the kids try to escape, first to the wood and then back to the earth, but each time Queen Jadis grabs a hold of them and she's drawn in. Eventually, she's drawn right back into London, right back to Andrew's study, and she grabs Andrew and makes him into her apprentice slave, and then she sets out to take over London. And it's a wonderful scene, but luckily the kids are thinking more quickly now, and they use their rings to take Jadis back out of the earth. But they make a mistake. They don't just take Jadis with them. Uncle Andrew gets dragged in, and a cab driver named Frank and the cab driver's horse, remember this is the 1900s, the cab driver's horse whose name is Strawberry. Well, they're pulled in, but this time the rings don't carry them to the wood or to Charn, but they are carried instead to a new world. Now, I'll let you try to figure out what that new world is, because I want to go on a slight tangent for a moment. Before I continue the plot, I would like to consider for a moment the characters of Andrew and Jadis. For in these two ruthless Machiavellian villains, Lewis offers a powerful portrait of the Nietzschean Superman. One whose satanic will to power and Faustian lust for knowledge is both boundless and unquenchable. Andrew and Jadis care nothing for the people that they use. You see, they consider themselves to be above bourgeois standards of good and evil. Like Nietzsche, they are above good and evil. They are the Übermann, and they don't care about our standards. They have stepped outside of the Tao, to use Lewis's language. Well, in the novel, Lewis sounds the measure of their utter narcissism and egocentrism. As I already told you, Andrew is willing to sacrifice children to further his occult studies. He doesn't know if they'll come back alive. Jadis, even worse, we learn that she destroyed Charn by speaking the deplorable word, a spell with the power to destroy anything, everything, except the person who speaks the word. You see, this deplorable word, Jadis said the deplorable word. She knew what would happen, but she feels totally justified in what she did because she believes that her people are her possessions. She thinks they belong to her, and therefore she could do anything she wants to them. More of this Superman idea. Not only that, she really thinks that it was her sister's fault because her sister pushed her into saying the deplorable word. So she feels no guilt. She takes no responsibility for her actions. Now, as you might guess, the deplorable word is almost certainly meant to be a reference to the atom bomb. In fact, because remember, it was written in the 50s. In fact, at the end of the novel, Aslan warns Polly and Diggory that the coming Earth century, which is the 20th century, will be one of treachery, deplorable words, and Jadis-like tyranny. And certainly the 20th century has been just that, with the totalitarian rules from the right and from the left. Now, in many ways, this statement at the end of the novel marks the only overtly political statement in the Chronicles. Lewis was interested in general political issues, totalitarianism and whatnot, but Lewis didn't usually have references that specific. In fact, some people don't know this, but Lewis never read the newspaper. He felt it was a waste of time. He always was reading, but he never read the newspaper. And so he tries to stay away from anything that's too overtly political. He kind of stayed out of that, which I think was good for the wideness of his appeal in some ways. But let us come back to the plot. As you might have guessed, our travelers find themselves in the about-to-be-born world of Narnia. And Lewis, in a reworking of Genesis chapter 1, conjures up a breathtakingly beautiful creation. As you might guess, Aslan is the creator. Remember John chapter 1, through him, Jesus, the world was made. So Aslan is the creator, and he literally sings Narnia into creation. It's absolutely beautiful. And as he sings, the stars appear, and then the stars begin to sing. Remember in the book of Job, they talk about the sons of God singing in the sky? I mean, it's a beautiful scene. Now, as you might guess, Diggory, Polly, Frank, and Strawberry are captivated by the song. Even the horse loves the song. In fact, Frank says, "If I had heard that music before, I would have been a better man." I can't do Cockney, but he says it in Cockney. He says, "I would have been a better man if I had heard that music when I was young." But what do you think Andrew and Jadis think about it? To them, the music is horrible. It's like a brass glove scraping on a chalkboard. They hate the music, and they cover their ears and don't want to hear it. In fact, Jadis's hatred for the music is so intense that she takes... Okay, when they were in London, as a weapon, she had ripped off a piece of a lamppost, made out of metal, of course. Well, she gets so mad at the song, she takes the piece of metal and throws it right at Aslan's forehead to kill him. She doesn't even know who the lion is. Well, of course, the piece of the lamppost bounces off of his head and lands on the ground. But do you know what happens? Almost immediately, it grows into a lamppost. Now, I didn't tell you this, but in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, when they go through the wardrobe and enter Narnia, the first thing they see is the lamppost. And the lamppost is the only sort of modern thing in Narnia, so you wonder where it came from. Well, this is where it came from. How did it grow? Well, this is the first day of Narnia's creation. The soil is incredibly fertile. Whatever you put in grows. Later on, the kids put some candy, and it grows into a candy tree. It's kind of neat. Now, all of us would be, how wonderful we could grow things. What do you think Uncle Andrew thinks? Andrew thinks, think of all the weapons I could grow. I could grow tanks. Remember the old song, they took paradise and they paved paradise and made it a parking lot? Well, this is what Andrew's doing. He wants to turn paradise into a munitions factory. I mean, again, here is the utter baseness of evil. It cannot even respond to good. In the face of fertility, all it wants to do is create more weapons to kill more people. Slowly, the song changes, and what happens is the earth starts to move, and then bubbles form, and then the bubbles burst, and out of each bubble comes a different animal. It's a wonderful way of creating the animal world. Then all the animals get in a circle around Aslan. And to a chosen portion, Aslan walks up and sort of touches his nose to their nose. And when he does that, they become talking animals. He only does that to a remnant, maybe 10 or 20%. Then he tells the talking animals that it's their responsibility to watch over Narnia and take care of the other animals. But he gives them a stern warning. He says that they must not do evil or they will forfeit the gift of language. Narnia is now complete. But alas, Aslan must tell everyone that already evil has entered into the world, of course, in the form of Jadis. And so, to combat this evil, Aslan sets two remedies in motion. The first remedy is he exclaims, Frank, the cab driver, the first king of Narnia, then he whisks his wife from the earth into Narnia to be the first queen. And that is why you may have wondered why you have these human kings and queens of Narnia rather than animals. Well, Aslan makes a decree that from now on, the kings and queens of Narnia will be human beings. You see, it's more fun to read The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe first and then find out the origin, or if you want to call it the etymology or the etiology, I suppose is the better word, of why this is. The second remedy is that he sends Diggory on a mission to get a magic apple that will protect Narnia. And that's what I want to tell you about now. Now, the quest for the magic apple turns out to be, like Perelandra, a replay of the temptation in the garden. In the Western world, if you hear the word apple, you have to think of the fall of Adam and Eve. Now, Diggory is accompanied on his quest by Polly and by Strawberry. What Aslan does is he says, Strawberry, would you like to be a flying horse? And he says, oh, yes, Aslan. So Aslan touches him, and he grows wings like Pegasus. My son has a little make-believe horse, and he named his horse Fledge. My daughter named her horse Sassy, which gives you a sort of insight into her character. But anyway, my son's horse is named Fledge. He loves the story of Fledge. Well, on top of the back of Fledge, they soar to the highest mountain in Narnia, and on top of the mountain is a walled Edenic garden, and the tree is in there. Diggory goes into the garden alone, and in there he meets Jadis, who has just eaten one of the apples, and by so doing has gained eternal youth. Then she turns to Diggory and tempts him to ignore Aslan and eat the apple himself. Go on, child, eat the apple, and you will be immortal. But good old Diggory says, no, I don't want to live forever. And then Lewis says, sort of parenthetically, of course, when Diggory went to school, boys and girls were still taught that it was morally wrong to steal. They still were taught virtue in the late Victorian age. Our kids aren't taught virtue. The only virtue our kids are taught is not to be racist, sexist, or homophobic. And those are good things. Tolerance is very much a part of the Tao. But that is not the be-all and end-all of the Tao. And since those isms are ripped out of the Tao, what it usually means to our kids is not tolerance, but relativism. In fact, I would sum up the modern generation in one word, whatever. And that is what tolerance often means to them. Because it's been ripped out of the Tao, all they know is relativism. What's the difference? You like chocolate, I like vanilla. So we're still taught virtue, but we're not taught the Tao anymore, the moral code. Let's go back to the story. After the first temptation fails, Jadis reminds Diggory that back in London, his mother is deathly ill. And this is the hardest temptation for Diggory, because the Jadis is saying, don't use the apple for yourself, use it for your mother. And as you know from Lecture 1, Lewis's mother died when he was the same age as Diggory in the novel. So it's a temptation for Lewis as well. Well, luckily, Diggory, even though it's difficult, resists temptation and carries the apple back to Aslan. With this apple, Aslan plants a tree of protection that will basically protect Narnia until the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe comes along. Then he takes one of the apples and gives it to Diggory to give to his mother. You see, when you submit, you truly get the desires of your heart. And then Aslan breaks a cardinal rule of Narnia. He actually tells Diggory what would have happened if he had stolen the apple and taken it back. Now, I think he breaks the rule because this is one of the first times where the child does the right action instead of the wrong action. But whatever, he tells, there, I'm using that word. In any case, he tells Diggory, this is what had happened. If you had stolen the apple would have healed your mother because its power is real. But Diggory and his mother would have lived to regret her recovery. They would have become quarrelsome and hated each other, and it would have been worse than if she had died. Just so, Jadis now has immortality, but her immortality will bring her neither joy nor rest. She will remain fixed in her evil, and guess who she will become? The White Witch of the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And she will never be able to break from her evil, egocentric narcissism. He brings back the apple, and it heals Diggory's mother. Then Diggory takes a seed from the apple and plants it in the ground. The apple grows into a tree. Many, many years later, a storm comes by and blows down the tree. Diggory, who's older now, takes the wood from the tree and builds it into a wardrobe. And, well, I'll leave you to guess what happens next. Let us move on now to the final chapter in the Chronicles of Narnia. And that is the last battle. If the magician's nephew is Narnia's genesis, the last battle is its book of revelation. Employing the most esoteric, apocalyptic language of the Chronicles, Lewis describes the end times tribulation, last judgment, and final destruction of Narnia. And I've got to say, don't start by reading this book because it's very hard to understand. And children may have a little hard time with this book. It's rather complex and esoteric, but of course, still well worth reading. This is how the story goes. Narnia's last days are set in motion when a Machiavellian ape named Shift convinces a donkey named Puzzle to dress up like a lion and pretend to be Aslan. In other words, he becomes a false messiah, or in Greek, an antichrist. And most of the Narnians are fooled into believing Puzzle is Aslan. Anybody can tell. It's just a stupid old, cloak they've put on him. But everybody is fooled. Unfortunately, it's worse than that. Not only are they fooled by the phony Aslan, but through this, is ushered in a new relativistic faith that teaches that Aslan is actually the same as Tash. Remember I told you in the last lecture that Tash is the pagan deity of the Calormenes? Well, with this false messiah, a new relativistic religion springs up that says Aslan and Tash are really the same. In fact, they create a new deity and call him Tashlan. Now, what happens is because of this, there's this sort of relativistic and moral it's a sort of moral chaos actually springs up. And in the midst of this moral confusion, Rishta Tarkin, a tyrannical Calormene, uses that moral confusion to seize control of Narnia, and he sets up Shift and Puzzle as figureheads. But he actually controls what's going on. Now, Rishta claims to be serving Tashlin, but he in truth is an atheist. And you know this is often the case. How many people have there been who took over something in the name of Christ or Yahweh or Allah, but they didn't really believe in any God? Well, that's what Rishta is. He claims he's doing it for Tashlin, but he's an atheist. He's merely using this new relativistic religion. Now, Lewis's moral here is probably too complex for children. But perhaps the older reader will recognize a powerful critique of how modern relativist thought, in striving to make all religions equally true, renders them all equally meaningless. If they're all the same, as a lot of people say today, then they're all meaningless. I mean, you might as well dismiss them because, you know, they lose their integrity. And that's one of the things Lewis is getting across. Now, there is a bright ray of hope. An underground resistance loyal to Aslan and led by Tyrion, the last prince of Narnia, springs up, but its members are martyred one by one. Then Eustace and Jill actually return to Narnia, but even they cannot stem the tide of moral and political disintegration. The lowest point comes at the climax of the novel, when Rishta, mimicking the fascist and communist propaganda rallies of Lewis's day, stages a grand meeting by a stable door. These are the Nuremberg rallies, basically, with all the flames and torches, and, you know, he's trying to get the sort of a charismatic thing to pull the people. And he has this stable door, and he tells everybody that on the inside of that stable door is Tashlin waiting to greet you. And it's all staged. And then there's a cat named Ginger. And if you're a cat hater like me, you're going to like this part. Ginger is basically Goebbels. He's the propaganda minister of Rishta Tarkin. And the plot is that Ginger is supposed to go into the stable, pretend that he saw Tashlin, and then come out. But instead, about 5 seconds after Ginger goes into the stable, you hear this great scream. Ginger comes running out with a look of terror on his face. Everybody says, "What's wrong, Ginger? What's wrong, Ginger?" But the only thing Ginger can do is say, "Meow, meow." Remember Aslan's warning. Ginger misused his gifts of speech and intelligence and has lost his status as a talking animal. Now, shortly thereafter, to figure out what's going on, Rishta himself enters into the stable, and guess who he meets? Not Tashlin, but Tash himself, who is a vulture-headed, terrifying god, something out of a, you know, Egyptian tomb or something, this terrifying god. And Tash picks up Rishta and grabs him under his arm and takes him off, probably to devour him. Well, Lewis has a very clear moral here. If you call on the devil, he will come. Beware. I believe one of the greatest dangers of the New Age is this new idea that if something is spiritual, it must be good. Well, I would say, and Lewis would agree, that spirituality is neutral. There is good spirituality, God and the angels, but there's also bad spirituality, Satan and the demons. And so spirituality is not an absolute good. But a lot of people in our day and age want to believe that if it's spiritual, it must be holy and good. Well, Rishta finds to his destruction that is not always true. Then Tash, after devouring basically Rishta, turns to Tyrion, who's also been thrown into the stable. The stable looks small, but when you get inside of it, it's huge. It's kind of like that other stable, Lewis says, in Bethlehem, that contains something bigger than the stable. That's the metaphor Lewis is using. Well, Tyrion has been thrown in there, and Tash is about to devour Tyrion when suddenly he is rebuked, Tash is rebuked in the name of Aslan and disappears. Now, you may be wondering where this rebuke came from. Well, it comes from the seven kings and queens of Narnia. And they are Peter, Edmund, Lucy, Eustace, Jill, Diggory, and Polly. Now, if you're listening, you're going to ask what happened to Susan. Lewis tells us that when Susan grew up, she got vain and she became what Christians today call a backslider. She lost her first love for Narnia and has lost her right to be a queen of Narnia. Some people see that as kind of cruel, but that's part of life as well. People do backslide and give up on their commitments. So anyway, the seven kings and queens, how did they get there? Well, we find out that all seven of these kids have just died in a train crash. And in the last second before their death, they have been transported to Narnia to watch the final end of Narnia. Because remember, a second would be like, you know, a week in Narnia. Well, as darkness descends on Narnia, all the animals parade before the stable door where they are judged by Aslan and go off to his right and his left. Just like the sheep and the goats, Matthew 25, the righteous to the right, the goats to the left. Then comes the end. And Lewis's awe-inspiring account of Narnia's end includes forests devoured by dragons, a mighty deluge, and a giant who squeezes out the sun like an orange. Wonderful, wonderful moment. What's Lewis's message here? Lewis wants us to know that nothing on our earth lasts forever. Everything must come to an end. And I think this is a message that we need because we live in a death-denying age. I think Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who wrote On Death and Dying, would like this part of Narnia. Lewis wants us to know that everything comes to an end. Everything physical comes to an end. We've got to understand that and accept that. Well, let us end by giving Lewis's description of heaven. Because at the end of the novel, all the good characters end up in Aslan's country, which is heaven. Let me end by describing heaven in Narnia. Well, we learn that there is both a heavenly Narnia and an earthly Narnia, just as there is a heavenly earth and an earthly earth, if you will. And the heavenly Narnia, Lewis says, is like Narnia, but it is far more glorious. In fact, the heavenly Narnia is the origin of all that was most beautiful in Narnia, the earthly Narnia. And the same is true for our world. Or, to put it platonically, and Lewis is being platonic. In fact, one of the characters in the novel says, hey, Plato was right. And Lewis says that basically the heavenly Narnia is the form, whereas the earthly Narnia and our earth are only shadows. We live in the shadowlands. True reality is in heaven. Now, when we get to heaven, we meet all the heroes from the other chronicles, Reepicheep and Puddleglum and all of them. And we expect that. But we meet somebody else we don't expect. We meet a Calormene named Emeth. And Emeth had entered the stable door in search of Tash. But when Emeth went into the stable door, he did not meet Tash. Instead, he met Aslan. And Aslan tells him, Emeth, that all of the good things he did for Tash were actually done for Aslan, and that Emeth's search for truth has led him to Aslan. Emeth in Hebrew, by the way, means truth. Now, what is Lewis saying here? I mean, again, basically, Emeth would be a person from another religion, Muslim, Hindu, Buddhist, somebody that's not Christian. And yet, Emeth, even though he was following another religion, finds Aslan. What Lewis is saying here is similar to the Great Divorce. He's not telling us salvation is universal. What he's telling us is that anybody who truly desires God will find him. One of the things that Lewis seems to have believed is that if somebody didn't know Christ in this life, maybe when they died in that last moment, Jesus would appear to them and give them a chance. And the idea is, if you are truly seeking after the truth, well, if Christ is the truth as he claims, John 14:6, if he's truly the truth, then that's what you're seeking. So again, there's an openness to Lewis here. Now, the best way for me to explain this is to contrast Emeth with a group of Narnian dwarves who are also in the stable. And these Narnian dwarves are cynics. And they don't believe anything. They don't even believe Aslan. Aslan begs them to believe in him and come into paradise, and they say no. Then Aslan actually gives them a feast with, you know, all sorts of lambs and turkeys and whatnot and lots of beautiful, tasty wine. But when the dwarves drink it and eat it, it tastes like muddy water and hay to them. You see, the Narnian dwarves, even though they are, I guess we'd call them cultural Christians in the metaphor, even though they grew up as Christians, they don't believe. They're cynical. Whereas Emmeth, who did not grow up as a Christian, truly desires. It's the difference between the Magi and the Pharisees. The Narnian dwarves are Pharisees. Even though they were waiting for the Messiah, when he came, they rejected him and helped have him put to death. But think about the Magi. The Magi obviously weren't Christians, but the Magi also were not Jews. They didn't have the law, but they believed in the truth, and they followed that star. They used their own wisdom to seek after truth. And when they got to the end of their search, they found Christ in the manger. So again, if you truly want truth, you will find it.